First of all, I would like to thank the organizers to have invited me. For me, a real pleasure and also an honor of it. In fact, intercultural communication, this is a topic about which I have to should speak with you. Simply speaking, is something we consider to be the kind of a communication between people who have different languages, coming from different countries, having different styles, etc. This is a kind of a very intuitive, naive understanding of intercultural communication, which is not wrong. But however, the challenges of intercultural communication in our global society, global information society, are much more difficult, much more important, and so we have maybe to try to understand what's going on more in detail. For this, I would like to discuss five topics, yeah? But very quickly. The first is, what is culture? Kind of, in order to understand the challenges of intercultural communication today, yeah, in a global society, to which belongs Erasmus Mundus, naturally, we have to have a kind of a operational definition of culture. Then we need some notion of what is cultural identity. Based on these two notions, we can better understand the principal challenges of intercultural communication. I will speak about these challenges. And then also understand maybe better what are the obstacles. This means the reasons why intercultural communication is relevant. So to understand principal obstacles of communication between people belonging, let's say, to different cultures, to different, who speak in different languages, having different behaviors, and so on. And then I will again speak very quickly about cultural awareness. Cultural awareness, what is considered to be the means to improve, let's say, progressively, intercultural communication skills. Okay, the notion of culture. In fact, there are, as you know, many, many different definitions of culture, and the literature is full up of this. However, you can consider, it is possible to consider that the culture is a cognitive system that frames our worldview, so to speak, and which is based on three main features. The one feature is belief. Each culture has to be based on some beliefs. Second feature is knowledge. Each culture has to be based on kind of knowledge. And the third feature is each culture has to be based on some values and then on some rules, what you call laws, customs, traditions, habitudes, or habitus in the French term of Pierre Bourdieu, and so on. So, in fact, all cultures have to be somehow based on beliefs, knowledge, and values and rules. Beliefs doesn't not only mean religious beliefs. No, this can also be non-religious beliefs. A social, a political party, for instance, a nation, an institutional organization, what you call institutional culture, has to be based on some beliefs, assumed beliefs. And when you speak about knowledge, you have not only to think about technical or scientific knowledge, which is maybe this knowledge which is the most easy to be globalized. No, you have a lot of social knowledge, which is very difficult to be globalized. And then when you think about rules, you have not only to think on formal rules, like laws, what you call the juridical systems. No, there are really many, many traditional habitudes, rules, and so on that format our life. Well, these beliefs, knowledge, and values, in fact, are embedded in a mass of different cultures to which we are exposed and in which we are living. You speak about religious cultures, about language cultures, ethnic cultures, national cultures, and so on. And all these different cultures, in fact, constitute different beliefs, knowledge, values, and rules, and which interact, and which are naturally in the interaction sometimes and very often opposed, contradictory, and which creates what you call very often so-called untractable situations, blocked situations, where the situation where the communication possibility becomes very, very small. Let me speak quickly about cultural identity. How do we understand cultural identity? This means that cultural identity can be understood as a kind of a set of cognitive references that people who form a group possess in common. In other way, a cultural identity is a kind of a set of common beliefs, knowledge and values. For instance, common language, shared common interaction rules, routines and rituals, shared social perception of networks, of stakeholders, of institutions, of places and so on, shared traditions, customs, or again, very important, common references, what you call collective symbolism, the emblems, the big texts, the monuments, important places where you have to behave in a certain way, or again, personalities, and finally, events, historical events, legendary events, and you know, the events are extremely important as a reference for the interaction between nations, countries, and not always in the best way. Based on these kind of things, naturally, we can imagine that what we consider as intercultural communication is in fact either a mediated or a non-mediated communication between people who have in fact different sets of common references, different sets of beliefs, knowledge, values, and so on. And on the basis of this common statement, we can now identify specific major central challenges in intercultural communication today. The first challenge is a challenge which is very often assimilated to what we call social communication. The example is very simple. You have an urban space, especially of big cities. On this urban space, you have cohabiting people belonging to different communities, different ethnic communities, different linguistic communities, especially different religious communities, etc., etc. And these people should, so to speak, cohabit, live together, work together, and interact if possible. And this is naturally one of the most important challenges we are facing in Europe, but also outside of Europe, naturally, and especially in urban or peri-urban contexts. For instance, you have the case of Paris, which is well known. The point is how to adopt or to respect common socially accepted rules and laws or values to these different communities. This is the most important issue in intercultural communication that you are practicing in our countries. Second point is what we call the challenge of sustainable development communication. And this is the main issue of so big institutions as UNESCO, or UNESCO, and UNO, and so on. Yeah? The point is here that, in fact, you have different regions in the world, communities, which are in very big, very difficult economic situation, and how to help these communities to initiate their own autonomous development. This is a second central issue of intercultural communication. This is to help communities, poor communities, excluded communities, communities which are marginal in another community, how to help them that they initiate their own autonomous development. This is in fact one of the central issues of strategic communication of the World Bank. The third issue is a reciprocal challenge to the second one is the cultural and linguistic mediation. This means what? You have in France people coming from outside, what you call the immigrants. They're coming to France and they have, so to speak, to be adapted to this country. This doesn't mean only to have been integrated linguistically to speak the French language, or again to English language if you go to UK, or German to Germany and so on. No, you have also to give these people the possibility to understand the social structure of France. This means where you can have a work, where you can find schools, where you can go to hospitals, and all these kind of things, how to be able to defend your own rights, and so on. What you call the alphabetization programs. It's a very important challenge, the third challenge in intercultural communication. The first challenge concerns international communication. This means the cross-cultural consensus building between people who act globally. This means, in fact, the creation of common spaces, of common structures, of common international or transnational structures, like, for instance, Erasmus Mundus. This is one very, very typical example. Another typical example for us is the European Community, European Union, you call now, and so on. And finally, a last challenge is what we call the intercultural marketing and management. This means to understand the specificity, the cultural specificity of people, of destinies for our products, services, and so on, in order to better sell our things. Well, these are the main challenges. There may be other challenges, but however, these are very recurrent challenges defining intercultural communication as we understand now in modern information society. Now, let me come quickly to the next topic. What are the most prominent, the most known obstacles that impede inefficient communication and that, in fact, justify work or research in the cultural communication? Well, the first obstacle, it has already been mentioned by the speakers before me, is the obstacle of the foreign language deficit. Foreign language deficit doesn't only mean to speak or not to speak English or French or Chinese or Japanese, etc. No, it means to have a notion of the all sociolinguistic registers in the language. How to express, for instance, politeness, how to express, for instance, the relation of respect, how to interact in an intimate communication, and so on. There are many very different, very, very fine sociolinguistic stratifications inside a language that, in fact, in general, constitutes a very important obstacle and a very visible obstacle. The second one is what you call the social face management deficit. This is coming from the American sociology of Irwin Goffman. In interacting with people who have different cultural references, different beliefs, for instance, different habitudes, different traditions, even if I'm not doing it intentionally, I can bless them, hurt them, I can make losing them the social face. So this is a second very important obstacle we are facing in intercultural communication. A third one is very important and which justifies especially the alphabetization programs is the lack of an understanding of a knowledge, of an appropriate knowledge of the social structure, of the social world which is specific to a given cultural community. This means, for instance, the community stakeholders, we are always speaking, the networks in a community, the social places in a community, and also the management of the social time. When you wake up, when you work, when you go to bed, and so on. All these kind of things which are very, very evident becomes less evident when you move to another culture. So this is a third very important obstacle. The first one, language. The second one, social face management. The third one, this kind of management or understanding of a community-specific social world. And finally, the fourth obstacle, which is so to speak evident, is the cultural ethnocentrism. This means that I am judging the other with respect to my beliefs, to my knowledge, and to my values. And it's very important. If, for instance, I give an example in France, the discussion about the burqa. the discussion of Burke, you know, is so is this how to judge, how to behave with respect to these kind of things. This is very important, in fact. Anyway, it's a problem of ethnocentrism. And belonging to ethnocentrism, there are two small errors which are extremely common. This is the common sense mistake. What is normal for me is normal for you. And this is naturally what you call a kind of an overgeneralization. So you say, well, I behave like this, and naturally you too. And the other one is the best intention in mistake. What I suppose what is the most, the best thing for you, must be the best thing really for you. But this is not the case, in fact. I'm projecting only somehow what is good in my sense for you is something what is really good for you. Voilà. And finally, how to improve intercultural communication. This is with what we call cultural awareness. I have to say, in fact, the fact that people don't have an appropriate intercultural communication skills, this leads very often to what is called blocked situations, situations in which you don't have any communication, where you have violences, riots, or again something what you call a communitarian introversion, that the people don't, however, communicate anymore. And so, for a kind of a global information society, which would like to be really a kind of a democratic one, this is naturally it's a mistake. It's a failure. And what is put away is the notion of cultural awareness. This means this notion of to be aware of my own specificity, of my own specificity, who I am in my beliefs, in my knowledge, in my values, in my rules, to be already aware of whom I am, and then to be aware of the difference concerning you. You are who. And so this kind of cultural awareness is in fact can be considered as a knowledge resource. This means behind this notion of cultural awareness you have a lot of learning programs, a lot of curricula implemented who try to make understandable people what is a specificity, a cultural specificity, and how to analyze this cultural specificity you call cultural analysis. And this is a very important issue, actually, in universities and also outside of universities. I also again come back to UNESCO, which is really one of the most important institutions in this sense, doing a fantastic work. The second thing is that cultural awareness is also a kind of a social technology. You have to understand that in 20 years before, or 30 years before, we have spoken again from the appropriate knowledge transfer, for instance. This means a kind of a directed communication from our side, from the European side, to a non-European side. Actually, this kind of paradigm is completely finished. What is now the favorite paradigm is participative programs, grassroots programs, public participation, and so on. This means to imply people in the negotiation process in order to find a kind of a consensus between people or communities who in fact don't share the same knowledge, values, or beliefs. Voilà. This is what I would like to say in a very short way, in a very short time. I agree with you. In fact, there's a danger of a kind of an overemphasizing of the cultural specificity. You can, what you call the cultural exception. This is a notion which is rather fashionable in specific countries. The point is, the argument is the following one in concerning cultural analysis. If you cannot position yourself in this cognitive landscape, where you have so many different cultural identities, topics, and so on, if you cannot find your own place, it's difficult for you to understand the distance between you and this culture. This is in this sense. Since 5-10 years, there are different institutions, especially in the Anglo-Saxon world, or UK and the USA, who are doing very interesting work on areal studies. This means a kind of a localization of the cultural diversity, in fact it is, on the physical geographical space, so to speak, and to have a kind of a country navigator, they call this, no? And this, I think, is very interesting to have, the danger is that you will create a kind of a stereotypical representation of the country, because in fact, like an institution or an organization already has different cultures inside, and a kind of a permanent negotiation between the different cultures, you have naturally this much more again in the country. But however, I think it's a useful tool, so to speak, very, very, very useful to have a smell of what's going on. Merci. No, I agree with you. I agree and I disagree. I agree with you that in fact of the importance of the central importance of the historical dimension in culture. You cannot imagine like a language. A language needs a history to be created. And so also culture. What you have in culture, for instance, I take the national culture of France. This national culture of France is documented through the historiography. This means through books historians have written about the culture, the history, and so on of France. Now, you take, you have a kind of a framing, of an official framing, and these are people, the students, the young people, people who are looking on the TV are somehow reading, and they become identified with this kind of history of France. Now you go to the south of France, for instance, to the people who are speaking another language, Occitanie, for instance, and they have a rather different vision of the history of France, a rather different vision, and the books they are written about, the history of France, extremely different. So I agree with you that, in fact, you cannot imagine a culture without a historical dimension, and I agree with you that, in fact, the scholars in social sciences, not the historians, in social sciences, have very often forgotten this dimension. But in my opinion, the historical dimension is what you call in semiotics a narration. It's called the speaking about your origins and so on. And so you have a kind of a power play between the actors in the culture, what is the official version of your history to which you have to believe. I don't think that's a kind of an objectivity. This is what I have to say.